y'all. Sarah here. I am back with another episode from the No Bad Ideas vault that usually stays hidden away and only our patrons have access to it, but we are re-releasing it for the month of December in our classic episode series. This one's just fun. This one is just fun. It is our episode with our dear friend and collaborator, Noah Mazur. Noah is an incredible voice actor and an incredible comedian and just an incredibly insightful person. And so we sprung an idea on him. He sprung an idea on us. We talked a little bit about comedy. And I thought, especially as the year is winding down, it'd be nice to have something on all the podcatchers that is just wall-to-wall comedy, and that is Noah. So we hope you enjoy this classic episode. We are hard at work making the last few episodes of Unseen, and we will be back in your feeds soon. But for now, please enjoy The Mouse Always Wins.
This podcast features three supposed adults who definitely use adult language. They're also supposedly writers who are definitely not procrastinating by making this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to No Bad Ideas, the storytelling game show where we take the worst ideas from the internet and turn them into stories that are actually good.
I'm your first Bad Ideas host. My name is Gabriel Urbina.
I am your second Bad Ideas host. My name is Sarah Shackett.
And I am lucky number three, Zach Valenti.
And today, excuse me, Zach. I'm so sorry.
Now he's no longer at your service.
Yeah, no, I ruined it.
He was at everybody else's service. I'm at your... What's the opposite of service?
Displeasure.
Anyway.
Yeah. Moving on. Dear listeners, today we have some bad news and some good news to make up for the bad news. The bad news is that as the holidays descend upon us and the snows pile on here in New York City, we here at No Bad Ideas are going to take a little tiny bit of a break. We're going to be away the last 2 weeks of the year. We're going to be spending some time with our families and with a couple of other projects and just, you know, in general, get away from the studio. It's traditionally the only 2 weeks that they let us be away from the studio. The rest of the time.
Those bastards.
Don't insult the ghosts of the studio, Zach. They can hear you.
I have the right.
But never fear, we're going to be right back in your feeds the first Monday of the new decade. That's January 6th. We'll be back with some more bad ideas for you. So look forward to that. But also look forward to right now because we are joined by a very, very, very special guest in the studio today. We are super lucky to have gotten a chance to collaborate with this gentleman on three projects so far in our podcasting career. He's one of our acting hat tricks. He was Mr. Daniel Jacoby on Wolf 359. He was Mark Midland on Time Bombs. He was most recently heard in our 1920 special episode of our new series, 0 Hours. It's Mr. Noah Mazur.
Thank you. Thank you. The displeasure is all mine. So
that goes wild.
Yes. Every time I actually do anything, I just imagine the crowds. So.
That's contributed to your success so far, I think.
That's right. You know, Fake it till you make it. High ego, big brain.
That is actually the real secret. It's not visualize the outcome. It's visualize the crowd's reaction to the outcome.
That's right. It's results first is where I come from. Results oriented.
Noah, thank you so much for being here on No Bad Ideas and joining us for the hijinks.
I'm happy to be here. And the ghosts have only locked me in temporarily.
So. That's good.
Benevolent ghosts.
Well, why don't we talk about what we're going to do here today for anyone that might be joining us for the first time. Here at No Bad Ideas, we find examples of people doing things that are somewhat misguided.
Poor judgment.
In poor judgment, yes. Things that in general you might describe as a bad idea. And we kind of kick around different ways that we might turn those bad ideas into pitches for good story. And today we're going to be trying to turn two bad ideas into good stories. The first one coming from our dear co-host, Sarah. What do you have for us?
I have a story in a very, very near time period in the galaxy that's this one.
Oh, no.
Guys, we have a Star Wars story.
Oh, no.
Just for you, Noah Mazur. This comes from The Verge's TLDR section. And dear listeners, if you want to read along with this article, the link to it will be in the description for this episode. And yeah, there's just several bad ideas, and I am curious which ones you will pick up
we'll
on
seize
and
upon.
Run with. So Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker, which is the upcoming Star Wars film.
That episode 9.
Episode 9, indeed. That may be out by the time this episode is out, or maybe not. I'm not sure. But anyway.
I think it'll be the next Friday. Yeah.
I see. Yeah. A script wound up on eBay after John Boyega partied and forgot about it.
Oh, no.
John, no.
Bro.
There are few secrets in Hollywood as sacred as anything involving new Star Wars movies, which is why when an authentic Rise of Skywalker script ended up on eBay, people at Lucasfilm panicked. Director J.J. Abrams told Entertainment Weekly that an anonymous actor left the script under his bed, a housekeeper found it, and gave it to someone who posted it for sale on eBay.
Whoa.
A Disney employee saw it and purchased the script before anyone else could.
Man, wow. Earn that holiday, wow. That wow. Holiday bonus, Disney employee.
What on earth
though
did they
Abrams
pay for
may
that?
Have tried to keep the actor's name anonymous, John Boyega, who plays Finn in the new trilogy, told Good Morning America it was his fault. The issue, Boyega said, is that he forgot the script was under his bed while partying with friends. Truly, whom amongst us can fault him? May he without sin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Quote, I was moving apartments and I left the script under my bed, Boyega said. I was like, I will leave it under my bed. And when I wake up the next morning, I will take it and then move. But then my boys came over and we started partying a little bit.
Oh my God.
The script, it just stayed there. And a few weeks after, this cleaner comes in, find the script and puts it on eBay for like £65. That's about $85, which tells us two things. The person who listed the script didn't know the true value.
No.
And Boyega's mishap could have led to The Rise of Skywalker being ruined for a measly $85.
Whoa.
Most people get in trouble for these kinds of things. The Rise of Skywalker costs hundreds of millions of dollars to make, market, and release. The secrets held within are worth big dollars to the House of Mouse. Especially considering this is the final installment in the Skywalker saga arc to this franchise, which it has never been called that before, at least to my eyes, because that is very hard to say. it was scary, quote, I got calls from every official, Boyega admitted. Wow. Even Mickey Mouse Ooh. Called me. What did you do?
What did you do?
Nice.
I will kill you.
Just to show how secretive Lucasfilm and Disney get about the new Star Wars movies, here's Mark Hamill on what it was like to film The Last Jedi as told to Polygon in 2016. You get your pages in the morning and they take them from you as you walk so they can shred them before it somehow leaks.
My God,
you have security lines you have to walk through both to and from set. And not to mention you have to wear these big monk hoods to protect your costumes from drones. Lucasfilm and Disney are companies who will go to extreme lengths to protect anything from getting out. It's not surprising that Boyega would catch some major flack for just leaving a script under his bed. Perhaps what's more surprising is that Boyega and the rest of the cast were given full scripts. Look at Avengers Endgame, another popular end to a long-running franchise full of secrets that Disney and Marvel Studios don't want getting out. Actors on set did not get full scripts. The pages they did receive often contained fake dialogue just in case. Mm-hmm. Very few actors in the movie even knew what happened. Members of the cast were told that a crucial scene in the movie, Tony Stark's funeral, was a wedding, and that's why they were dressed in suits.
BT Dubs, spoilers for Endgame.
I don't care. So look, maybe it's Boyega's fault for leaving the script under his bed, partying and forgetting about it. Arguably, this should act as a lesson to Lucasfilm and Disney that all scripts should come preloaded on a password-protected iPad, or only certain pages should be given at a time.
Damn, son.
Yep, I'm gonna put 15 minutes on this here timer. Okay, film nerds.
So, two things before we begin. Although, go ahead and press
timer. It is going.
I am intentionally squandering our precious time with these two tangents.
No, don't worry about it.
First of all, I want my next music project, my next band, to be called Boyega's Boys.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
And number two, like, man, send that Disney employee a bottle of champagne. Like, you know, like,
remarkable.
That's a fucking employee right there.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so it's a heist, right?
It's either a heist or like a gangster movie. Like, I'm sort of thinking of those movies.
Give me
like
the wolf.
Like a ransom.
I got a mess on my hands and there's only one person that can fix it and he needs guns.
No, like I'm thinking. Boy, it's going to be hard to get through an entire sentence. No, but I'm thinking of those movies like Rock and Rolla, where it's about four different criminal gangs all fighting over a painting and right. Who stole it and who's going to get it back. Something like that, where you have kind of some like pretty tough gangster dudes all fighting over. And I think it needs to be like one page of the script. Like
it can't be a full script.
No. It needs to be like,
that's unbelievable.
And there's a deadline because it's going to be worthless when the movie comes out.
Exactly. Right. Yes.
So they have to get it and then they have to sell it. And they can't let anyone else see it, because if anyone else even sees it, they'll have the information that's on the script.
Right.
So if anyone else sees it, like it's worthless, or it's worth just as much to them as it is to the original person.
But, you know, one of my favorite characters in this original setup, aside from John Boyega, who I love and I think is right. One of the most wonderful people on the planet right now.
And what an understandable mistake.
What an understandable mistake, actually, though.
Not when you're with the boys. You can't be helped when you're with the boys. Yeah.
No, but
the ultimate alibi.
The sort of somewhat hapless housekeeper.
I know.
That only put it up for like 80 pounds or however much it was, 65 pounds.
Yeah. Who just clearly was the wrong person to find this.
Oh my God.
And so to make a profit.
I was waiting for the 100,000.
Right.
And it never came.
And so I just love the idea of kind of someone in sort of like this like very minimum wagey, underpaid service position. Something like this lands on their lap, but they have no idea how to get the money that they know it's worth. Like, they're kind of looking at this and being like, I know that this is valuable. And so
I can't just put it on eBay.
Well, what if it's like their kid who has this big dream, like a Willy Wonka situation, where it's like the kid has like this thing that he wants and he has nothing, and then finds out that their parent maybe like has this thing and their parent doesn't know the value of it.
Right.
And this
right.
kid is like, oh my God, you know.
I feel like there's a B plot. So like the A plot is like these intense gangster, like, you know, just experienced people like plotting and trying to locate this thing. And the B plot is like the really older, like slow, you know, who's like finds the script and like, oh, this must be worth something. And
right.
They have like coffee on it for a week.
So
and,
it's like a thriller.
Yeah. Right.
Like they, this person, and maybe it's just this old person, or maybe it's this kid who inherits it from this random person,
right,
is caught up between, you know, the mega overlords who own the movie script and then the gangsters who are trying to get it, and they're the only one with the info.
No, and it needs to be the gangsters steal it. Like, the beginning of the movie is an actual heist. Like, people are breaking into J.J. Abrams' house and they're putting the script in this briefcase.
They pull it from the mystery box.
And there's this complicated drop-off system where they're getting it to the airport. And then at the airport, they accidentally switch briefcases with an old guy. And so A-plot is the gangsters tearing apart New York City trying to find the thing.
Jeez.
And then, like, the B-plot is this kind of, you know, hapless, fuddy-duddy kind of guy that is sort of like, you know, like, is this one of them Star Wars? Like, you know, and he's like, I think this
Bob
is valuable.
Matthew would love this.
Right. He's going to like the local pawn shop because he's like, well, when you have something valuable and you want to make money, you take it to the pawn shop.
Oh, man.
And the guy at the pawn shop is kind of looking at it and like knocking it about and, you know, leaving it right next to the open flame.
Yeah,
and meanwhile, you know, the gangsters are going apeshit trying to find this thing.
And maybe it's like it becomes like a, you know, North by Northwest like chase across,
across
like, you
America?
Know what I mean? Like yeah. That, like the kid has to run and jump on a train, you know, and then and the gangsters are after him, or the old, like whoever, the hapless person or the hapless person's hero, whatever. And perhaps the thing that they're that they're doing in the story is essentially parallel with the actual movie script.
Oh, I like that.
It's about, so like script is like that's a thriller about going across the country.
Sure.
I like that.
And the kid is like acting out the like dreams of basically of this hero in the movie.
Ooh, I like this.
Yeah, the
this
movie becoming real. I love that.
Or it's even more exciting than the actual movie was supposed to be.
Mm.
But yeah. Then why is the movie so valuable? Or I guess it's just a big pop culture iconic.
This is the question, and it's sort of like, when is this going to be set? Because gangsters and stuff, that suggests to me like 40s, maybe 50s at the outset.
But, sure, sure.
But if it's a Star Wars, then, you know, it needs to be present day.
Right, right, right.
I think that it can be sort of any big event. Sort of a movie, like it can kind of be, you know, it's the last movie made by this beloved director before he passed away unexpectedly or something like that. And maybe it's sort of this like Alfred Hitchcock like figure that he was known for the suspense and the mysteries and the twists. And so there's sort of like real value to kind of someone that would be able to tell.
Knowing.
What like the final big twist is, or what the final big mystery is.
And if this is in like the studio system era, then like there's definitely a rival studio that wants to get their hands on this.
They hire the gang, the boys.
Yeah,
they hire the boys. I love that. Done.
I do love that. I was going to say though, like the value of keeping it present day in Star Wars is that you can then sort of have the plot line, whereas the gangsters are trying, or the criminals, or whoever it is that actually stole the script.
Angry
As they try to find them, they realize that they are being doggedly pursued by this like way more intense, way more violent gang. And they're kind of going like, oh, my God, like, you know, is this the actual like Sicilian mafia? Is this the Yakuza? And then finally it's revealed that these are like the Disney enforcers that are
my boys.
Hands up, motherfuckers.
Right.
That is a great joke.
Right. And the criminals are all sort of going, you know, like, I've been putting people through wood chippers for 30 years, but I've never seen brutality people are unleashing.
No mercy.
Yeah. And then at the end, you know, what happens? Does the person holding the script reveal it? You know, spoil it for everyone? Or do you know, in that case, the criminals would get their wish, you know, or do they give it back, you know, and in which case, you know, is that person, you know, going to jail for holding on to this thing? Or
it kind of depends on what the tone of the movie is.
Right, right, right. Like,
because
cynical Zach wants it to be the mouse always wins in this town, Chinatown.
That's a great tagline. The mouse always wins.
Yeah, just like
right. Whereas the version of this movie directed by Frank Capra kind of ends with the guy that has the script, the kind of fuddy-duddy guy, being offered $100 million, but turning it down to kind of go into the first screening of the movie to watch it, having not even read it. Because the experience of watching a great movie is priceless.
Yeah. Right.
You know, like, but it sort of like depends. Are we watching kind of Charlie Brooker's version of this story? Are we watching Frank Capra's version of this story?
Yeah, were they live stream reading it aloud?
Or I'm now back to my like idea of like the North by Northwest. Like, what if the criminals or somebody who wanted to take this script also killed the director.
Ooh.
And like caused the hype around this script because
this
they
is
like
gonna
assassinated.
Be their Bitcoin. They're just like, yeah, they're just like.
Yeah, yeah. And that was sort of like part of it was like, these evil corporations that are just like, we for entertainment, you know, we just need to, you know, create as much marketable hype as we can.
Right. They say you can't get rich quick. And I say you're not trying hard enough.
No, you know what's the real thriller version of this idea? This is completely going off in a different direction, but I think that
you have 5 minutes.
Okay, okay. So
30 in order to do it. So that's fine. You have so much time.
It's not a movie. Okay, they're all on an ice rink.
No, here's a 20-second tangent of the real thriller version of this story. It is some fanboy kind of gets his hands on this script, and he's someone that hates one of the actors or one of the directors associated with this. And he's sort of going, you know, unless this person surrenders themselves to X sort of thing, every half an hour, I'm going to read another page of this script on a live stream. Yeah. And just, you know, like the closer and closer to spoiling,
right?
You know, like what happens at the end of Rise of Skywalker or whatever.
And don't try breaking in because I have it all on Dropbox. It'll go live if this monitor.
Exactly.
Yeah. If the live stream cuts out, then the whole script goes with it.
I have it set up.
It's just, it's like, it's, you know, it's the guy who's like so, he hates people that are upset about spoilers, and he's like, I'm going to show them. I'm going to spoil it for everyone. Yeah. You
know? Just has a break and is just like, I'm going to spoil the entire country.
No, and like, it can get to a real like paradox place of kind of, you know, he's trying to make a point about spoiler culture. It is, I want Disney to post an accurate summary of this movie on Wikipedia. Ah. And the longer that they don't do it, like, you know, and as long as they don't make that available, I'm going to not just spoil the plot, but spoil like all the lines, you know, all the content of it.
Right.
Anyway, that was my thriller tangent. Now back to
and
the
then
gangsters.
It turns out he just wrote it up. He made it up himself. He never even stole it. He just like, it's just like,
it's like his fan copy.
Yeah.
But plot twist, he thought that he was doing it as a joke, but it turns out
but
that
it's
his
very, very
beat
accurate.
Matches it beat for beat. Like in some real, like, damn, you know, like Stranger Than Fiction sort of a thing. I've just got these two writers just
the executives are like,
insane.
Thank God we know for a fact that he hasn't stolen it. Oh my God, how did he get the opening scene?
Right.
He's just Patton Oswalt's character from Parks and Rec, and he is that focused. Three minutes 18, by the way.
Okay. Do we want to pivot into the most important discussion of what is it called? Or do we want to keep working on this droll plot that like doesn't have an ending?
This droll plot that now like
You have two plots to choose from.
Right.
I think like going on three more or less.
I feel like it could be called something like the final page or something. Like,
okay, let's land the page. Land the plane.
In the air,
plot,
a paper airplane,
and then see if we still have time for names.
Okay. I mean, I think that like out of all of these, the one that is the more probably the one that I think lends itself to more actual structure is the one that is the hapless, bumbling fool kind of accidentally inherits the most hot button, culturally valuable script that some hardened criminals have stolen and have misplaced. And
present
sort
day?
Of, yes, let's sure. shoot from the hip. Great. Present day, it is Star Wars, it is the Avengers. It is, you know, the fourth Matrix script. It is a big sort of cultural thing that people are very, very, very invested in both not getting spoiled and spoiling at the same time.
Yeah, there could be a sort of satire of everyone wants to know what happens with this guy while they also don't want, the whole reason that this thing is important is because they don't want it to be spoiled.
Right.
But exactly. They also, everyone's tuning in because they're so excited about what this guy's doing.
Right. Like, you know, like the CNN viewership is through the roof for totally. Their coverage of this bumbling, you know, kind of Bill Murray-esque man who knew too little, kind of oblivious guy. Who is going through this whole experience much like Mr. Bean would without ever realizing.
So what's the lesson that's learned?
Or who, don't or who fuck with the mouse.
Sorry,
right,
I can't
like
let that go.
He keeps avoiding mishaps until the last 10 minutes of the movie where he is finally captured by the agent of the mouse, and the last shot of the movie is him being dissolved in acid.
Oh no!
With the screen,
and then
being
the acid goes down as
hand.
Part of like the waterfall of Splash Mountain. No, but it's probably something about that, you know, having multiple interests in your life and not fixating on pop culture, probably a good thing.
Yeah, right. That is.
That is a much more wholesome, realistic.
So, right. Yeah, everyone just puts way too much effort into this thing that the end doesn't even matter.
And it needs to sort of be that, you know, that he is visiting L.A. to spend time with his daughter who lives there, or to... you know, pursue some hobby. He's there for his mini golf convention or something that is very innocuous and very innocent and utterly divorced from the world of filmmaking and show business.
And that's time.
There we go.
Oh, that was fun.
I'm glad you liked it.
Man, what a wild story, though. Like, the original sort of article.
You can't make that shit up.
No. My God.
I kind of believe that it's someone's job at Disney to make sure if these things end up on eBay.
The internet for that?
Yeah. To just snap them up.
Yeah. We have, not to go on a tangent, but there are actual services if you own public property or intellectual property that will actually like track the internet and track, you know, deep websites and things like that, and look for things that might be compromised, leaks, things like that. So there are literally services that do that.
Wow.
There you go. Wild. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Fuck with the mouse. Mouse fucks back.
Watch yourself.
Yeah.
And on that note,
we're going to see if we can chase some of these cartoon characters out of the studio. And we'll be right back.
No.
Hey, y'all. Breaking into the show for just a moment to hawk our wares. And this time, I have actual physical wares that I can hawk to you all. We put out, if you're a fan of our first audio drama series, Wolf 359, we put out a gorgeous new t-shirt that is Wolf 359 related, sort of a little red star, blue star front back situation. It's very, very cool. I'm very, very jealous of Zach Valenti, who has the sample shirt. And you can go check it out in our store, which is conveniently located at store.wolf359.fm. And if, you know, t-shirts aren't necessarily your thing, ha ha ha, you're not getting out of this so easily. We also have put up for sale in our Wolf 359 store all of the behind the scenes material that we generated in making seasons 3 and 4 of that show. So we've got commentaries, we've got fun watch along videos of us watching things that informed the making of our show. We have a whole podcast that we did making a podcast. I heard you like podcasts, so we got a podcast for your podcast. It's called Retroactive Cleverness. It's very funny. So you can check out all of those things. They're available as a bundle, or you can sort of buy a la carte if one thing strikes your fancy over the other. But there's a bunch of really cool behind the scenes material. So if you are a fan of Wolf 359, it is not to be missed. And to buy all of those things, again, you can head to store.wolf359.fm. Okay, back to No Bad Ideas. We are back with yet another bad idea. This one, I think a first on the show, provided by our guest, Mr. Noah Mazur.
Who would have thought
a wild guest idea appeared?
Always blazing trails, Noah Mazur.
Well, this article comes from the Oregonian newspaper.
Oh.
Excellent.
I think courtesy originally, I saw this probably on Reddit's Not the Onion, which is probably
oh dear, oh God. Good start.
Oh boy.
In 2019.
So I'm just going to read. This came out. This was originally in 2018.
Okay.
So I'm just going to.
Then it's fine.
A simpler time where things. Yeah. Anyway.
I'm just going to read the whole article. So the headline starts: Boyfriend who survived samurai sword attack, it scared the living poop out of me.
Okay. Cool.
Alex Lovell nearly lost his fingers, his life, and he appears to have lost the woman he loved. Otherwise, he's feeling pretty good. I was just so proud for beating the samurai wannabe crazy lady with hate in her heart, Level 29 told the Oregonian in a Facebook message exchange Wednesday. I've been preparing my whole life for something like this.
I've seen the story. It is wild. Yeah.
The woman, Emily
Javier. I believe I've heard about it, yeah.
30, his girlfriend of 2 years. Javier faces attempted murder charges after she told police and a 911 dispatcher she attacked and repeatedly slashed Lovell with a samurai sword during the wee hours of March 3rd. murdered. The incident has drawn national and international headlines. It's also landed Lovell in the hospital, where he remains recovering from multiple wounds and lacerations. In an interview with the police after the attack, Javier claimed she found a Tinder dating app on Lovell's phone and also fumed over his penchant for playing too many video games.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Holy God.
Lovell admits he may spend a bit too much time in front of a computer screen, but he insists he never cheated. I barely had time to hang out with my girlfriend, let alone another girl, he said. In recent months, Lovell said he had spent 12 to 13 hours a day playing and training for PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds,
a computer game. Checks out.
Where players parachute onto an island, gather weapons, and blow each other to bits. The long hours also required him to spend time doing exercises for his hands, wrists, and shoulders, and also practicing mouse moves and techniques to maximize his performance.
Whoa.
Quote, dude. I wasn't a sweaty nerd, more of an athlete, Lovell said, describing a person who has an intensive online gaming regimen.
Oh my God.
Javier told police she hatched the assault on Lovell after she found evidence he had been unfaithful. First, there was the Tinder dating app. Mm-hmm. Then she saw sexually suggestive scratches on his back.
Whoa.
Finally, Javier found red hair in the couple's shower drain, according to police bureau. Her hair, on the other hand, is dyed green.
Lovell it's just said, such an evocative picture.
You were wondering why. Wow,
this is a good. It's a good radio story. As more details come in,
it just gets better. Basically, she was delusional. He said in her interview with police, Javier said she had suspected he had cheated on her before, an accusation she had said he always denied. She also mentioned she had grown increasingly incensed by the limited attention he paid her. Javier told police she grew enraged, went to the shopping mall, and purchased a samurai sword.
I was going to ask whose sword it was.
Where did you get it from? What?
A vape shop, probably.
There are stores that sell them for reasons that are unknown to me, but I've seen them in malls, and it's freaked me out of kind of why is this just here?
Bizarre.
Yeah.
At about 9 p.m., she went into the couple's bedroom where she had taped the samurai sword and two knives to the side of her bed.
Wait, what?
Oh, my God.
Lovell later joined her and drifted off to sleep. Javier told police she hid her boyfriend's phone so he couldn't call for help.
Holy shit.
Whoa,
yeah.
She was mad.
After the lights went out, Javier said he retrieved his samurai sword, then brought it down on her boyfriend, according to a probable cause affidavit. Lovell said he woke up to being attacked by Javier. His instincts kicked in. And he drew on a lifetime of kung fu films and martial arts training.
No.
Quote, I was able to Wing Chun my way to survival,
Fuck
Lovell said,
me.
Referring
he
to a traditional form
it.
Of Chinese martial art that focuses on close-range combat.
What the fuck?
Eventually, he got her into a bear hug. I saw the look in her eyes, and it scared the living poop out of me, he said. I told her I loved her, and she was killing me. She needed to call police, or I was going to die. Some more stuff happens.
Oh, holy God.
She calls the police.
This is the worst idea we've ever heard.
His index, middle, and ring fingers were nearly lopped off at the base, though the doctors have been able to reattach them. Obviously, I got some gnarly injuries, he said.
Oh my God.
Gnarly is the word, sure.
But my favorite line
is... His athlete career must be over.
Lovell is savoring the
That's really
small...
sad. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah.
Lovell is savoring the small victories.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, the feeling I had when I won the fight with my bare hands is just absolutely the best feeling.
Oh, no! It's like it's so much better than video games.
With his various appendages
mostly
gone.
Yeah. Like bleeding Holy onto shit. The bed.
And the best line is, I've played all the sports, won big games, landed some decent tricks on my snowboard. This was better.
Oh, my God!
Oh,
my God.
Hats off to the writer of that article.
Is happy.
Because all of the information was arranged in the correct order.
Dear listener, apologies if you heard coughing in the background of that. I took a sip of tea in the wrong moment in that account.
Are there any questions or clarifications before we begin the timer?
No, start that fucker.
No, sir.
All right, and...
I need a cigarette.
Begin.
I don't even...
So we're just making, like, 0 hours season two. Just one of the stories is this, right?
No, you know, we talk a lot about...
It just starts with... Swing, scabbard open.
No, I think that it's worse than that because I think that it's sort of this like slow burn of like, you know that it's a 0 hour story. So you know that it's something that is about the end of the world.
Yeah.
And you just like begin with this guy kind of
playing video games.
And then, you know, his girlfriend comes
honey?
Home
yeah.
and they talk for a little while And you can kind of tell that she seems maybe a little passive aggressively mad about something, but you can't quite put your finger on it. And the clock is ticking, you know, like 10 minutes have passed and you're like, when is this going to go off the rails? Like, what is happening? And then eventually, you know, the guy is like, oh, well, I'm pretty tired.
I'm going to go to bed.
And then, you know, you wait for just like a little bit longer and then swing.
You hear tape sounds for whatever reason.
Well, oh, that would have been at the top of the episode.
I'm saying the tape removal sounds.
Oh, I see. Yeah. See.
Just like crinkling of packing tape. Just like, what? And then swing. Anyway.
You know, we talk a lot about what makes a good idea for no bad ideas. What makes a good bad idea, if you will. And every now and then there are some ideas that we have to disqualify just for, well, there's nothing to do. You just film it. It's the thriller of the year. Like, you know, and you're done. And I think that this might verge on that territory, but it's not quite there. So let's see what we can make of it. Let's see kind of how we can structure
11 for 10 for density.
I think.
Oh, my God. Oh, it's so funny, though.
It's so great.
Like, it's so wild and so vivid of a picture.
I want to come back to these people like 10 years later and see what's happened to them.
They both seem like such characters. Yeah. And, like, they both seem.
Deserve each other almost.
Yeah. I would also be delighted to kind of. I would want like the his her version of this, kind of like the story is told from his perspective and then the story told from her perspective, because I'm curious about how she perceived him, quote unquote, Wing Chunning his way out of it.
Yeah, what is that even?
It's a martial art form. It's like famous by from like people like Donnie Yen, where they do like really fast, like close combat, like kind of stuff where you're like doing a lot of like blocks and like using the opponent against you. It's like particular kind of kung fu that like this guy would know for like, you know.
Right.
For movie reasons.
Yeah.
But it's one of those, if you're watching the Rashomon version of this, when it is the story is filmed from his perspective, he might look pretty Donnie Yen-esque.
Badass.
He's kind of, you know, like blocking.
There's like a backflip in
there. Sort of trips her and then.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you sort of see it as filmed from her perspective. And it's like, a lot more flailing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a lot more of kind of him thinking that he stopped the sword, but the sword actually hitting the bedpost behind him and he didn't even notice. You know, and it's sort of much more of a, I can't believe that I had all of this bad luck. And that just kind of stopped me.
For a Rashomon version of this, I feel like I need more perspectives than just those two.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe like we invent a roommate or a friend or something just to have like, and they can also sort of be a very particular character. Like, I don't think we should have objective truth in this version of the story. Mm-hmm.
I think that in that case, it needs to be the guy's lover.
Oh, sure.
The person he's cheating with.
Who is hiding in the closet the entire time or something like that, under the bed or something.
With a sword? So she allows it to happen?
Well, and it might sort of be like one of those things where there are sort of little details in each story that kind of don't make sense until you see all of them together.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe... And I don't know, like, this is kind of where it would take, like, actual careful architecture and actual careful planning. But you might sort of, like, see something where someone, like, their roommate in another room is, you know, like, around earlier. And maybe he spots the sword and it's kind of like, huh, that's strange. But he doesn't think anything of it.
Right.
Because he then kind of gets a call about something else. But then later on, we see the sword come back. I don't know, but like, you know, sort of like stuff like that, where at first you think that it is just the two of them in the room. But as the film kind of keeps resetting, you keep learning that there was kind of like someone underneath the bed, someone that was kind of hiding out in the bathroom for like a different reason, someone that was outside their window watching it all. And it just sort of like keeps multiplying.
And they're both clearly delusional.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You guys have 10 minutes.
Ooh. To take it in a completely different direction,
please.
Because I think that that is a very solid way to build this. But just for like, just to waste a minute of our time.
Yeah, please. We have so many of them.
Double digits, baby. I am interested in like what happens to this guy who now thinks he can fight off people with swords. He now believes that, like,
who also is like bored of video games after.
Oh
this.
Yeah,
right. It doesn't fill the hole anymore.
So it's fearless.
Oh man,
you know, like right. he
just becomes a fucking sword wielding vigilante.
Or not even sword wielding, but just kind of like he thinks that he's like a bare knuckle, you know, yeah. Street fighter sort of capable person.
When really, he is a
incredibly
a
lucky
word, a bitch slapper.
He's right. Just
like, right. And, you know, it's better to be lucky than good. but, you know, the story sort of begins with this, and we maybe see it from his perspective. But as we go through the film of him, like, trying to sort of find that adrenaline high again, mm-hmm. we can go back and sort of see what actually happened.
Yeah, and there needs to kind of be a roommate or a friend or a brother.
Right.
That as this guy is kind of going, like, wow, I'm invincible now. The friend can be kind of going,
you're really not.
Actually, you are incredibly lucky. Like, you should be falling to your knees in gratitude for being alive. And the guy's going, invincible, yeah, wow.
And this guy just becomes a thrill seeker,
right? And so he's kind of, you know, like enrolling in, you know, kung fu tournaments, and, you know, picking fights in bars, and just kind of like all of these very kind of stereotypical tough guy,
right.
dangerous
things you see at the beginning of a Wolverine movie is what he's doing.
Yeah.
Right. Meanwhile, his ex-girlfriend is training.
Oh my god,
I love it so much.
She's going back for more. She's gonna finish where she started.
She's like, I must.
She's just in the mountains.
Become the master
with the sensei.
In prison, one assumes. Which is a place that you can train, I suppose.
I really want this now to also be set in the land of Scott Pilgrim. Like, I think
that's right. So it's just like super over the top.
That's
fighting.
Kind of where they both live anyway.
Right. Like,
it feels like a comic book.
Yeah.
Seriously.
No, like sort of this kind of, you know, like these two guys had a dispute where for whatever reason, one partner came to believe that the other one was cheating. And it's, you know, sort of like carried out through the logic of street fighting video games and, you know, like sword wielding and all of this crazy stuff.
So I'm just imagining the A plot and B plot of like him like trying to get more action,
mm-hmm.
and like in his head being a hero, but in reality just getting involved in like criminal activity and like doing so haphazardly and putting way more people at more risk.
Right.
Right.
Cut to, she's pumping iron in prison and like shaving down shanks and just like.
Maybe she's not even in prison. Maybe she got off on a technicality.
Sure. You know? Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe she's just in like
she
her
lives
own.
A different
she's
part
just
of town.
Sharpening
yeah.
the knife that is her.
Right.
And does it like culminate in her?
I mean, eventually
him?
they have to clash again.
Right.
Crushing
him just in time before he does real harm?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's the fight that we see from a completely objective point of view where these two people are not coordinated or good fighters at all.
And that's the one where the friend that has kind of been shadowing him and keeping him out of trouble the entire movie is kind of like, ah, fuck it. You know, I can't keep doing this. Like, you know, you guys want to fight? Fight. Like, yeah. I don't care anymore.
And yeah. maybe they're doing all this stuff to like distract from the fact that they actually like miss each other.
Yeah.
And like, you know what I mean? And they want to be together, but they refuse to admit it.
Right.
You know, and they're just too insecure.
And yeah, they have to sort of break down and sort of get that stubbornness beaten out of them, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they realize why they liked each other to begin with and become an invincible Fortnite team. That's how this ends.
Amazing.
Well, you still have 5 minutes.
All right. Let's see. So let's talk a little bit about these two characters and let's flesh them out a little bit. And
sure.
I think sort of if that is going to be the ending of the movie and that is going to feel satisfactory, then he can't actually be cheating.
No, I don't think so.
So then sort of what is it that went wrong in the first in the relationship, or kind of what was the thing that was,
I mean, he
sorts?
could sort of fancy himself as like being a super hardcore athlete, And you know, and watching a lot of kung fu movies and not really listening or respecting that she's into that stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sort of typical.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Girls like,
aren't real gamers.
And you know, they can have conversations about, you know, what their favorite DC comic is. But he doesn't, in his heart of hearts, believe that she is as intense and her are, you know, as real a person as he is.
Right.
And so that's why he spends so much time gaming instead of hanging out with her.
Right. He's like, I have my priorities straight. Like,
right. And, you know, I'm not a loser. I have a girlfriend. She's awesome. She has green hair. But that's kind of like, but like it's a very shallow relationship on his end.
Yes.
Which leads her to believe that he's invested, you know, the bulk of his relationship in someone else, when really it's just a shallow relationship.
I see. Okay. And what is it that makes them ultimately be good together? Like, sort of like, what is the thing about them that sort of does fit together, aside from their superficial combined interests?
Sure.
They're both delusional.
Intense? Are they commit?
Right.
I'm trying to find positive.
Is it one of these kinds of like, you know, like these two people are, you know, like they should be together because that way they won't harm anyone else.
Right.
Like, like they'll only sort of be terrible towards one another.
Right. They just thrive in the drift. Like they're both just like, you know, like if they gamed together, they would overcome their
right
their so like differences.
So like this ends in a real kind of like Sid and Nancy place of kind of at the end of the movie they're like, you know, riding off in like motorcycles to like do daredevil things together
on one of those like what's where there's two bikes but with motorcycle like on one
yeah,
bike,
yeah, yeah,
with
yeah.
motorcycles
like a tandem motorcycle. Yeah,
tandem motorcycle.
Like,
that's
maybe
right.
They're not badass on their own, but
together they can be.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And right. Clearly he would need to get over his superficiality.
Yeah.
And
she would need to sort of let go of that jealousy that she clearly has.
Right. And
and possessiveness that she clearly has.
Become part of the program in the sense of like putting in the reps to like go toe to toe.
Maybe like they for whatever reason feel or, you know, can go this distance with each other in a way that they can't relate to other people.
Mm.
I see.
The good friend, the saintly friend who is somehow around, like, is probably treated very different than how they treat each other.
Interesting.
In a minute. What are we going to call it?
Ooh.
Oh, we're going to call it two-player mode.
Nice.
Till death does us part. No.
Versus.
Versus is good.
That's a very good one. Yeah. I like that.
I like that a lot.
Yeah.
PvP.
Wing Chunning it.
It takes two to tango. No.
Looking for group is an actual comic. That's something that already exists. I'm trying to think of something with a samurai sword.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about fingers getting cut off from the base. It's so gross.
Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah.
Well, no,
like, final cut.
Well, that about does it.
Oh,
good
God.
Job, everyone.
Wow.
Thank you, Noah.
What a stellar idea.
Thank you for unleashing that bucket of dysfunction upon us.
It's truly incredible. I also love the word ethlete.
I know.
Like, it's like, yeah, I'm, you know, so like I totally think that like esports are like a real thing and that people should like, you know, totally have respect for all that.
And it takes
a
real physical discipline
absolutely.
To build up the abilities
but
that these
word
people have.
The word ethlete is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. It's amazing. it brings everything together. This guy is just an absolute, and this woman, they're both
absolute athletes.
They're both athletes of the top of their game.
All right, well, we're going to think of some other stupid words, and we'll be right back once we found a couple of them. everybody, welcome back to the set thing that we do, the subset for No Bad Ideas.
This is we've never had a set thing that we do.
I didn't get a script.
We never have a set. John Boyega's boy is stolen yet again. It's probably on eBay.
It's on eBay.
Probably on eBay right now for 100,000 pounds.
I got to stop partying with those boys. I mean, I really don't. I mean, it's
you don't
it's
have great. To. You're a star, Noah.
It's the get out of jail free card. Like, you know.
So funny.
Like, that's the thing that the girlfriend from the second story missed out. If she had just been like, look, officers, I'm really sorry, but the boys came over and one thing led to another. The officers would have been like, yeah, you know, like that makes sense.
Who
the
boys in their katana. Yeah.
Just file another one into the boys file.
It's just like a huge filing cabinet overflowing with folders.
Yeah. No, it's like the first drawer is like A through B O Y. And then like the second, third, and fourth drawers are boys.
Yeah. Oh, ma'am, you say your car was stolen? I'm afraid it was the boys. There's nothing we can do about that. It's long gone.
It's a shame that there's already an Amazon show called The Boys.
I know.
Ahead of the curve, that Amazon.
Like, that's about superheroes. It's
always
not
one step ahead.
Just right. Like the mouse. All right.
Let's actually.
Don't bring me back into this. It'll never end.
Oh my
end.
God. All right.
Although, is that lady with a katana for hire? Because I could really use someone to finish these things.
Enforcer. Right.
Boop.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to No Bad Ideas and to our third segment where we get a chance to kind of talk a little bit with our guest about what's on their mind, what they're kind of working and thinking about. And we actually, after we finished recording our second idea, we started talking a little bit about comedy and kind of about how we are doing a little bit of thinking about what works in comedy and what makes something not work in comedy quite as well. And especially about how it evolves, how it's a living, breathing thing that is kind of constantly changing and moving and updating. And after a certain point, we kind of went like, well, hang on a second. Let's actually just turn the microphones back on and talk about this because it's interesting. And it's something I think that we all think about and we all sort of have like different feelings about.
And it's delightful to get to talk about it with one of the funniest people I feel like I know.
That's very subjective.
As is comedy.
As is comedy. That's right. Yeah. I was thinking about this partly because, you know, we were also talking about writing stuff and then looking back at your old writing. And ever since I was little, like I tried to write funny things, like always, every time I would write something, especially like as soon as I learned to write, like actually like write a paper, you know, we're talking like fourth grade, fifth grade through like, you know, middle school and like early high school. I would the only way this is going to be interesting is if I can write like the funniest thing that I can.
Right. If it's amusing.
Exactly. And I would write something and I'd be like, this is hilarious. Cause I had just read, you know, I'd been reading a lot of Dave Barry. Yeah. I'd been reading a Dave Barry and Calvin and Hobbes. And I was like, this is what humor is. Mm-hmm. And which is what humor is. That's actually Dave Barry is the definitive.
He's closed.
We all have that fist.
and so I would I would write this like a paper or something and I would make it into a comedic paper. And then I would think this is hilarious. And I'd show it to my mom and she'd be like, this is hilarious. And then I give it to my teacher. My teacher, depending on the teacher, would be like, oh my God, this is hilarious. Or be like, Noah, we need to have a sit down, which happened. But like, you know what I mean? And I'd be like, wow, so funny. And then I've gone back and like read those papers, like literally like when I was in high school or when I was in college or after college and like read stuff, even read stuff that wasn't like when I was a child, like read stuff when I was in high school and like cringed so hard and being like, this wasn't funny. This was like, I could see myself writing this and being like, oh, like, I can't believe I thought this was like a good example of humor, you know? And, it, you know, it might've been at the time or it might've been that for a person my age, that was funny, you know?
Yes.
And it's interesting to think about in terms of not just in terms of growing as a person, but also as we were discussing before, just like comedy and culture over like, you know, decades. Because a lot of people will say things like, you know, people who get mad about like political correctness, you know, will see like a special from like George Carlin or something from like, you know, the 70s or the 80s. And they'd be like, you know, you couldn't say that today. Mm-hmm. You know, people would shut you down and you'd get canceled. And, you know,
George Carlin, who sort of very famously tackled a lot of very hot button topics, sort of was famous for kind of a very
irreverent.
Yes.
Approach to yes. things that people cared a lot about.
Iconoclastic, I would yes. say.
Right. And people looked at not only him, but also other people that were perhaps less tactful at right. doing so and say, oh, you know, they could never get away with this today, which to me is, I find a little bit absurd of a critique, because one is that, you know, some of them can and do. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's sort of like,
or don't, and it doesn't seem to stop their ability to earn money.
Correct. You know, yeah, they get away with it, so to speak. But the other is that, you know, humor is subjective and it's very fickle, and things that we find funny, you know, today we may not find funny in 20 years. And things like, you watch an old movie and things aren't, so a lot of things like old, like comedy stuff just isn't funny, either because it's just outdated. It seems cliche now, or like the cultural references we don't get, or it might be a little offensive. Right. Right. And so like right. all of those things can wear out a joke. And there's some jokes that are timeless, right? And some comedies that still feel just as funny. A lot of them, maybe it's slapstick humor, maybe it's certain kinds of humor that tend to last longer. But like certain,
but
things
even that, those are still tied to, I think, sort of our culture and our understanding.
Totally, yeah.
Of like what is incongruous, what is, you know, correct behavior, and how is this deviating from it?
Right, and so it's sort of like, yeah, if you're making a joke at a time, you know, you have to tailor your joke to your audience, which means tailoring your joke to your culture and to your time. And so, you know, that kind of joke, if we are more tolerant and more understanding of different kinds of peoples and more empathetic, then your jokes should either be that way or probably either need to be more aware of that to at least, you know, find someone to be able to like let their guard down about that. I'm not saying they have to be, obviously yeah. you can, you know, say anything you want and try to get paid for it. But, you know, I find that to be a bizarre critique, because it's a culture of a past, you know?
Yeah. I think that there's even also fascinating cases where a lot of comedy rots, a lot of comedy, kind of the things that made it funny get left behind, and sort of, we kind of leave the markers that helped us to kind of interface with it properly. We kind of lose those as we keep going forward. I think that there's also hilariously cases where we catch up to something
yeah.
where something that in the past was kind of seen as, oh, that was too offensive, that went too far.
Sure.
Nowadays, we sort of, there are certain things of it that people have actually caught up to them and are now able to kind of culturally interface with them a lot better. I remember there's a Billy Wilder movie that I saw for a class in college. And the professor sort of talked a lot about, back when I taught this class in the 70s, this was the example of a bomb. This was the example of kind of like, this is the one where Billy Wilder fucked up and nobody finds it funny, and let's dissect it. And steadily, as the years went by, more and more people laughed at that one.
Mm-hmm.
More and more people sort of like found it funny. Whereas now it's sort of an example of another successful Billy Wilder film.
Right.
Because people caught up to it. Whereas when it first came out, it was sort of this, oh, no. This is a little too frank in terms of the things that it's doing with sexuality, the things that it's doing with kind of unusual sort of like relationship setups.
Which one was it?
This one was called Kiss Me Stupid, I believe is what it was.
Okay.
And it was one of those like, the volume was subjectively too turned up on the sort of parts of it that made people uncomfortable, that they couldn't hear the comedy and the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is perfect for nowadays, which I don't know. I think the one thing that I feel like I sort of went off on a tangent on is and maybe indicative of that is like the internet's effect on fracturing our culture in a way where like, like, I really got a lot out of Hannah Gatsby's Nanette.
Yeah.
And then there's like this whole wave of people who just like can't hear that as comedy and see it as like more of a one woman show of a comedian that's like, you know, more about like, and that's just bizarre to me because it feels like it made me feel like I could do stand-up. It's a very fickle line
between funny and comedy, right?
Right.
Something that is marketing itself as a comedy and then something that is a story, but is funny.
Right. And I think I'm thinking more about stand-up just because that's something that I've been thinking about doing. And so I've just like mainlined a lot of interviews of comedians and a lot of stand-up specials and just have like been hearing a lot of, you know, murmurs about like these people are trying to define what comedy is, or these people are like not being funny and like using free speech as a way to, you know, sort of let themselves off the hook for degenerate views that I think the people that are doing that would say aren't degenerate. They're just like saying things that you don't want to hear. And so like, don't listen. And so it's complicated. It feels, and the fact that algorithms let companies monetize content in ways where it's like, I would never know that certain people exist because YouTube would never put that on my doorstep. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a whole other world of stuff always happening and more every day, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, comedy will always be there. There's something innate about comedy that like we all need to laugh. Mm-hmm. And that will always be something that we're sort of dealing with, and that it's almost like, yes, there is a genre, and that's part of what I think Hannah Gatsby is dealing with Nanette. Like she's such an expert at that genre that she can just break it down and subvert
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
But you know, it's also just like an innate characteristic of human beings, you know, that that comedy and humor, you know, it's like there in like Aristotle, you know, as like, you know, part of like, you know, the original dramatic mode of how people operate. And I think, you know, the way like you're saying, you know, people who have mean-spirited views and things like that, like that's, to me, that's like bullying. And like a huge part of bullying is comedy, like is sort of like putting people down with humor and mm-hmm. trying to get everyone you know to like laugh with you at somebody else's expense. And like that is an element of comedy, and it's like, you know, it sucks, and like it's probably something that the people don't like, but again, I think it's all part of that characteristic that is almost, you know, endemic to people, that it's just like it's a different facet of it, or a different output
of different
that
phase
kind of thing.
The diamond, so to
yeah.
speak. Sure.
Yeah. And so it can be used, it's sort of like it's a weapon, right? And so like it can be used for good, it can be used in like, you know, spice up something dramatic, you know, mm-hmm. have a bit of comedy,
disarms it a little bit,
right.
Sometimes
yeah. it can be something that, you know, you start and you lower everyone's guard by having comedy, you know, or by giving people the impression of comedy, putting people in that mode,
yeah.
and then pulling out the rug and then switching modes on you. So like it can be used in all sorts of different ways, or just to just be like, oh, people just want to have fun and just like give people fun, entertaining time, you know, with like keep it light, you know. So I think it's like a tool almost. And that doesn't mean that it's always going to be a tool for good, which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, totally. Especially because I think, you know, about what we find funny as kids. Mm. Versus what we find funny as adults,
mm-hmm.
and that progression, because comedy is just really violent, all of it, but especially, you know, you think about cartoons, incredibly, incredibly violent. And you sort of have to believe that when you're sort of dealing with that slapstick, that the things that are happening, they aren't happening to full people. Right? They're happening to characters. They're happening to cartoons. The Marx Brothers are not real human beings.
Right. No, they're kind of like elastic figures.
Exactly. Yeah. They're made out of whatever the same stuff that Gumby is.
Right. Well, yeah. In film studies, you know, we talk about margin of safety.
Yes.
Right. But there are some psychological terms where one humor theorist called it like the benign violation theory. Have you guys heard this?
Oh, yes.
I have heard this, yeah.
And that's like, you know, something has to be twisted, something has to be broken, or something has to be, you know, painful, but it has to be something that couldn't harm you, yeah. right? And that's the other, like the quote about, you know, comedy is when I was, no, tragedy, I'm screwing it up.
No, but I got you. I think like comedy is when someone else falls down a well. Tragedy is when I do it.
Yeah. Tragedy is like when I cut my finger. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, comedy is when you fall into a manhole and die. You know,
right.
It's like, well, it's happening to you, you know. And I think especially as a kid, when you don't have like a lot of empathy built up necessarily, yeah. it's even easier to just like watch someone get hurt and just laugh.
Yeah.
No. And that's like the progression of comedy is when you're a kid and you are a sociopath, because children are. we all were. It's fine. Mm-hmm. And you sort of gradually move towards comedy as a tool to sort of see what's wrong in the world and what prevents empathy, and then as a tool for empathy. And it's a spectrum, and there's stuff that's funny at every level of it. And it's funny to me, like now. Stupid violent shit.
I mean, stepping on a rake, it's just like...
it's just funny. And so like that's it's really interesting that you bring it up, because it is just like a facet of you yourself as a person that you can grow and develop, but also not.
This reminds me, there's a documentary series on Netflix called Dangerous Comedy by the dude who directed that movie Borat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a taste, but one of the things that I appreciate about it that I hadn't seen until I saw it is, I mean, I don't know if you remember, so there was a Chris Rock special back in the early aughts, I want to say,
okay,
where he just like kind of blatantly made a joke about you know, abuse, where it's like never okay to hit a woman, and then there's like something, it's just like he does something and it's like you would never make that joke today, sort of to your point.
Yeah.
And then they cut to a certain part of the world, I think it was somewhere in Africa, where like that is the comedy being made, and it's just like literally jokes from 10 years ago, and it's just, you see this like sort of trickle over of American culture in this sort of international way. And then you also start to see people emerging that are like starting to sort of move against that kind of comedy and elevate
right.
and bring in more female voices into the comic scene. And it's happening faster. So it's I don't know. It was one of these things of like just seeing these patterns sort of emerging, where it does seem like there is a global movement and sort of back and forth as culture shifts and isn't static, but echoes itself, but then evolves in ways.
Yeah, it's almost like fashion.
Yeah.
Know? Like it absolutely. Gets exported, and then some countries, you know, get, you know, the thing from that other country, but 2 years later, and then this other thing that right. comes out of them, and then it's like, you know, it morphs and then skews and then comes back around because it's referencing the thing right. from 20 years ago, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Like the idea of culture as like bacterial cultures, and like seeing, you know, seeing it kind of grow and then mutate. And then, you know, it's just interesting to sort of consider that aspect of it.
Here's a random thought that I'd be curious about you guys' opinions.
Mm.
Do you guys feel that here in the States, we get less foreign comedy than other forms of foreign entertainment? Like, do we see more foreign dramas than foreign comedies, for example? Or do we sort of...
I'm talking about the translation effect of, like, that it's harder to translate comedy than it is to translate, like, action and horror and things like that.
I suppose on a certain level I am, but I'm thinking of kind of, you know, like, growing up in Costa Rica, we saw sort of everything that was made in the States, sort of mm-hmm. like if it was a big release here, it trickled down there. And a lot of the comedies that we saw back home were, you know, all the Will Ferrell and Steve Carell and Jim Carrey and all those sorts of like big movies. It was very clearly in the early 2000s.
Sure.
I'm dating myself.
With subtitles or?
Yes, with subtitles most okay. of the time. But I feel like I'm kind of thinking about like the foreign films that play here. And I think that this is a little bit of the reason why Parasite caught so many people off guard.
Because it's so funny.
Yeah.
A funny movie. And I don't think that a lot of people are kind of used to going to a film with subtitles here and having it be the experience of a funny film.
But again, it's not billed as a comedy.
Right. It is not.
And it's funny you said that, because that's kind of
not a comedy
too,
in some ways.
When you asked that question, that's the first movie my mind snapped to, which was like, that was really funny and really messed up. And most of the movies that I can think back on weren't all that funny, or were more like art house funny.
Sure.
And led with a sort of dramatic, were consumed in sort of the drama or the ennui or whatever, you know, sort of like ponderous, sort of pretense. It was, you know, sort of targeting it, I imagine, the critics at Cannes.
Sidebar, my new like film imprint is art house funny.
That yeah, there you go. Yeah. Done.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, and also the humor is rarely like linguistic humor in that movie.
Yeah.
And in movies like, you know, in similar things where there's comedy, it's awfully usually like broader, more physical humor, you know, and situational humor.
Yeah.
Right.
That is what provides it, because, you know, linguistically it's hard to translate a joke, into across another language, never mind across cultures.
Yeah.
Right.
I was just thinking about, you know, a couple of years back when The Artist came out, and everybody was kind of like, my God, who is this Jean Dujardin character? Like, right. Oh my God, like, where has this actor been hiding? Is one of those, like, well, he's actually gigantic in France, in no small part because he played this spoof of James Bond that everyone saw, because it was the smash comedy of the year. And in France, he's probably as recognizable as that spoof of Bond as Daniel Craig is of James Bond. But that film never made it, as far as I know, that never got a release in theaters.
Yeah, it's
over
tough,
here.
Especially because I think in the States, and, you know, I include myself in this, everyone is frustratingly monolingual. So, like, it is, you need to do, if you're going to be funny, you need to do it with subtitles.
Right.
More broadly. And so it is, like, the challenge of translating joke humor or verbal humor from another language into English is very high.
And I also think that also comedies tend to be, you know, they take place in everyday life.
Yeah.
And everyday life is so cultural that can also be hard to translate. And that's why a lot of American comedies don't get exported to places where the cultural barrier is larger than Costa Rica, you know,
Sure.
or places like, you know, China. They're not going to be seeing, you know, the latest Will Ferrell movie, you know.
Right.
There was actually a really interesting story I read a couple days ago where, like, a very, very old, and by old, I mean the 90s, comedy.
So ancient.
Ancient comedy. Yes.
Practically a fossil.
Called the,
called
the Legend of 1900, which was a dud in the States.
Yeah.
And, like, got sort of panned, didn't make a lot of money. Made more money in China a couple weeks ago than like any of the new releases, Chinese or American, because just culturally, for whatever reason, it just hit the spot for the Chinese moviegoer.
Right.
And it is fascinating to sort of look at why it was panned in the States. And then maybe those are the very things that are appealing about it in China.
Which brings us to Tommy Wiseau.
No, and if I'm remembering correctly, sort of a lot of the criticisms of that movie had a lot to do with kind of, it is so slow and contemplative, and, you know, you're sort of kind
saccharine.
Of... Saccharine. Yeah, and kind of... And those are perhaps things that in more sort of Western cultures, to paint with a gigantic, huge overgeneralization brush.
Almost a comedically large brush.
A huge comedic brush. We sort of like have been taught of kind of, you know, like we have an attitude of impatience towards movies that we see as kind of wandering and somewhat meandering and maybe a little bit repetitive, whereas other places maybe have a lot more patience towards those qualities.
Sure. Yeah. And then other places may find, like, you know, it's hard to export a movie like Bridesmaids to like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Because they might be like, this doesn't work at all here, you know.
Right.
You know, there are all aspects of both culture and like comedic style and pace. I remember like recently watching part of the newest season of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yeah.
And that show I think is really funny. And then at the same time on that show, there are stand-up segments, and the stand-up segments to me are like the least funny part of that show because they're like old school, you know,
because the
show
is
set in the 60s, right?
Late 50s. And then this season is the, like the early 60s. And
it's, but like she meets Lenny Bruce in the first episode.
Like Lenny Bruce, which who was hilarious back in the day. And today I'm like, well, you know, listening to or watching like what is ostensibly, you know, material that's, if not directly his, is a lot like his. And it's sort of like, you know, like maybe worth a chuckle, you know, and it's like it's just a different world because it was a different time.
Right, all right, and I think that is all the time that we have this week, this year. Oh
this
my god
decade.
Like yeah, wow,
it's the end of the new comedy
but
in
Noah,
2020.
Thank you so much for being here and for hanging out.
Oh, happy to hang, you know.
I know that you are, generally speaking, an international man of mystery.
That's correct.
And you do not have Jejun things like a Twitter.
That's correct.
But is there anywhere that you would like to direct people if they want to see more of your work? Or if they want to, you know, check something out that you think should shine... they should shine a light on.
I think just all y'all, you know, you guys, I always want to work with you guys. So, you know, if you pay attention to your Twitter feeds and podcast feeds, and next time I work with you, I'll probably be popping up.
No.
And,
definitely.
You know, if, and I won't work with anyone else. So
great.
You'll never see me anywhere else. So it's perfect.
Excellent. Excellent. That's just what we wanted to hear. What a great note to go out on. Thank you, Noah, for being here, and thank you all for listening.
This has been No Bad Ideas, produced by Gabrielle Urbina, Sarah Shackett, and Zach Valenti. Many thanks to our patrons for their partnership in making this show happen, and a special shout-out to our idealist member, Rena Sarame. Today's episode features music by State Shirt and Jazar from freemusicarchive.org. You can support the show at patreon.com/nobadideas. And if you love the show, please leave a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thanks. See you next week.